transcontinental trip to Biden Mountain, Sid and a line, Leonard Bernstein, Leonard Brezhnev, Lenny Bruce and Lester Banks, birthday party, cheesecake, jelly bean, boom, symbiotic, patriotic, slam, button, that, right?
All right, Barb, with us this evening is Dr. Judy Wood, and this is the meat of the show.
This is
the meat of the show.
I'm excited.
We had done an interview on another show with her last December.
Yes, it was.
And her material was suggested to me by a couple of individuals over the year, and it was most directly related to the Hurricane Aaron that was headed straight for New York City prior to 9/11, and then in my work with weather wars and weather modification and electromagnetic weapons and climate engineering and all that hoopla that we have to deal with anyway. And, you know, I for me, I really pushed any relationship with Aaron to the World Trade Center disaster. I couldn't go there. I'm like, okay, we have a hurricane offshore. How do you... What's the deal?
Yeah,
other than bringing in a nice northeasterly breeze off the Atlantic to keep the skies just crystal clear across New York City, but that's not really here nor there, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But Dr. Wood, thanks for staying up late, really late
on your end. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
Your work is
phenomenal.
It's complete.
Yeah,
it's complete.
Is.
You know what? You can get with Dr. Stephen Jones and stuck on thermite. You can get stuck on the planes don't fit in the buildings. I mean, there's so many, for me, head fakes. You know, like, look here, look here, look here in this whole 9/11 scenario. But you seem to have managed to have seen through all of it.
Just look at it and see what's there.
Well, and isn't that what scientific method is all about? That you can look at a scenario and a situation objectively without any preconceived notions, and then to begin to apply your scientific knowledge and working in engineering background to a solution. Would you tell our listeners what your background is?
Bachelor's degree in civil engineering. And a master's degree in engineering mechanics, which is like applied physics, and a PhD in materials engineering science, which it's an interdisciplinary degree, and most of it was concentrated in engineering mechanics, but applied to materials and materials characterization.
So this makes you at least... And from what I'm seeing, almost ideally suited to come in and do a little forensics on this whole 9/11 issue.
Even better yet, my specific area of expertise is interferometry.
Oh, perfect for this one.
Well, would you explain that then? Because that word may have just gone over some people's head.
It's interference of different... energy sources, and my background is in optical interferometry, like interfering two beams of coherent light. And when you do that, you get walls of constructive and destructive interference. And a good example of an everyday example would be like dropping a pebble in a pond. You see the ripples go out,
right, right.
It's still a pond. If you drop two pebbles in, you see where the waves interfere with each other.
They'll either amplify or cancel each other's energy out.
Exactly.
Okay.
So how did you take all of this background knowledge of yours and begin to apply it to the 9/11 scenario?
Well, it wasn't really applying my background, you know, consciously. It was that I just started looking at the evidence of what was left and you start looking around to see what happened. Not what people tell you happened or what did it or who done it and all that business, but first you begin with what happened. Well, what do you know for sure? Like, as though you're starting a mathematical proof. What can you prove in your own mind? So I would look at all of the pictures, because there's an abundance of photographs out there by a variety of sources, and I don't ever rely on just one source. If you get the same impression from, like, five different sources, chances are that pretty much is representative of what's going on. And I just started noticing things that I thought were kind of weird and started listing them. For example, round holes in window glass, as though someone took a glass cutter and cut a round hole. Not a starburst or a spider web kind of pattern that you get when you hit a baseball through a window, but just like a round cutout. And upside down cars. But the most unbelievable quirk of this whole thing is, where did the towers go?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, let's go back to the round holes. Were those in the sides of, obviously not Trade Center 1, 2, but are you talking like six across the street, or where did you find those round holes?
All of the buildings adjacent to the World Trade Center complex. One Liberty Plaza, Bankers Trust, the WFC buildings, which are World Financial Center.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's just whatever windows that you could see.
What were the sizes? Just a couple of inches?
Oh, yeah. Some were larger, some were smaller, and they weren't necessarily perfectly round. Some were oblong, and some had a little lip. You know, looks like a frying pan kind of shape. Those were in the WFC building. I remember seeing those. But it just is bizarre. You know, I didn't make any conclusions by them. I just put them down in my list of weird things.
And so, but it was enough to get your attention.
Yeah, it's like I can't explain it.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't try to.
I just kept, adding things up. As I say, if you look at the data long enough and listen to it carefully, it'll tell you exactly what happened.
Yeah.
And if you don't know what happened, look at the data some more. Until it speaks to you and tells you.
Yeah. Well, that seems like the most objective way to go about looking at this thing. And as you were just getting to, I think it was the mushroom cloud that was just stunning that day. It made for great, enrapturing TV that morning.
Especially as you watched the towers tip over before they fell.
Oh,
the
before
tops
they
of these...
did what?
Kind of tip the tops of the towers, kind of tipped a little, and then they kind of came down from the top.
I was kind of teasing you about there is down, they just kind of went away.
They
didn't crash.
Where did they
ground.
Go?
Well, I mean, there was, what do you run from except this blizzard of powder?
Yeah. Dust and fuzz balls.
Right. And building four, which was right beneath where that tipping top of Tower 2 should have gone, it just disappeared. Like it was cut off with an X-Acto knife.
Four just disappeared. Oh, what, is that the comparison to the Murrow Building in Oklahoma City?
The one that looks like that is Building 6, which has the cylindrical cutouts. Like somebody took a big, giant post hole digger. And just took out the whole inside of the building. Like 50% of the mass of the building looks like it just disappeared.
Wow. Okay. Wow. So the story has that four planes were hijacked and dudes with box cutters did it. And we had John Lear on 2 weeks ago, who asserts that the whole thing was holographic in nature and that the planes just simply couldn't fly at those speeds before they hit into the plane. Okay, little Alanis Morissette has begun to roll, so we'll continue this discussion with Dr. Judy Wood as to where those towers went on the other side of the break.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN, great talk radio starts here.
How long before I get in? Before it starts, before I begin.
All right, everybody. Scott Stevens, Barb Adams with you, coming to you from Colorado this evening. On the phone with us, Dr. Judy Wood, and her research, which can be found at drjudywood.com. And I tell you, there's not a page on her list that just doesn't take a little bit to load, because
it's an amazing website.
It's an encyclopedia of everything about 9/11 that you wanted to know, but from a perspective that if you've not been there, you've never seen before. You've never mm-hmm. seen it from this point of view, and it will change how you look at 9/11. Thanks for being with us this evening, Doctor.
Well, you're quite welcome. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's you, and you've really kind of taken on the whole community, because they're set in this thermite mode, and that's just a piece of this puzzle.
Well, what other people want to think about this, you know, it's infinite. You know, there's lots of other things folks can be interested in, but I'd like to look at the data and the evidence and see what the data and the evidence say. There's on my website, I have a long list of all of these different phenomena that I've listed, and you know, didn't need an explanation. And what I kept doing is just looking at these various phenomena, wondering what they all had in common, and then pretty soon they really come together and convince you of what the issue is. I didn't know about directed energy weapons before I began looking at this evidence. But from what I know about optics and interference of optics, there's a parallel. And that's what allowed me to see what was happening.
To make the connection.
Yes, yes. And it's a parallel. Now, what they used, or they, whoever they is, what created the destruction on 9/11 involved energy, an interference of energy. And what really convinced me of that is the police cars on FDR Drive. They were just, I call it toasted. Toasted as in its history, it's toast. I don't know what happened to it, but it's really bad shape. Like a window frame being flopped over, just went limp. And the door kind of sagging. And there's this one car that has this beautiful new wax job on the back end, and right in front of it, it's totally toast.
Wow.
Like it's been scorched, like 1 nanometer between the toasted part and the new wax job.
Well, and the fire with these buildings was all above, what, like floor 50? I mean, all of the heat, all of the destruction was up high, so there's no way other than falling debris that any of this stuff should have been burned to any degree.
I have to laugh because as sad as this whole thing was, when you start looking at the evidence, it becomes, you know, kind of interesting. You have to, you know, find the humor in it where you can. But to say it was falling debris on the cars, there's a car that's not burning on the outside, but it's totally engulfed in flames on the inside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that. And there were other pictures, too. Some of the cars appeared to be flipped over, basically, like they levitated. And then, some of the trees right next to those cars are totally intact, and the leaves are
exactly
fine.
The leaves are still there on the trees, and like mm-hmm. there's this toasted bus, and you see the trees right behind it and kind of leaning over it, and they're all full of leaves.
Yeah, so how do you explain that?
Well, is it the molecular structure of the steel, of the metals, versus the biological of the trees? Is that could that explain how they behave differently?
Well, we do know from our own experience that when you put paper in a microwave oven, it doesn't cook. But water does. So we know that there's types of energy that affect different materials in different ways.
So could that explain when they found that one file cabinet that had survived? There was some colored paper in there, if I remember correctly, that was still holding its color. It was just fine.
Yeah, beautiful red and beautiful blue, little colored tabs. And so you know that this thing didn't burn up, but what happened to the file cabinet? It looks like it crinkled up and shrunk up.
Wow.
As did a lot of the metal and the metal beams, if I remember right. They looked like they actually had just kind of changed at their elemental level.
Well, that would be the Hutchison effect, correct?
Yeah.
That's right. The Hutchison effect, I believe, uses the same physics as what the destruction was caused by on 9/11.
So you're talking basically with the Hutchison effect, it's using radio frequency and electrostatic forces, correct?
Yes, using different types of energy interfering. And what also, before we leave the controlled demolition aspect, there's so many phenomena that just cannot be explained by bombs in the building. For example, the building didn't hit the ground with a thud. If it had, it would have broken up the foundation more.
Well, there would have been a seismic result,
well,
too.
Well, yeah.
And also, you would have piles of debris that had slammed to the ground. So how do things turn into powder in midair?
They were powder before they hit the ground. And I was expecting to see WT2, that top 30 or 40 floors, however many it was, somewhere on the ground. I mean, it was intact when it tipped over.
It was when it started to tip, and then poof.
And then it turned into this big, what I call a snowball, this big round blob of dust before it hits the ground. And if you slam one floor against the other, like the pancake theory, that's how you get things turning to powder. But in order to slam one thing against the other, the floor below has to be rigid in order for the floor above it to slam into it. And if you were to get the whole building on the floor, on the ground in, 9.5 seconds, you can't have a stationary floor there slowing down the motion. So you have a resistance paradox. You have timing of the building going away and the time it takes for the roof to hit the ground in a vacuum with no resistance, but you have this powder, which is what you would expect with lots of resistance.
But without any mechanical resistance.
Right. So it doesn't, something weird is going on there.
Mm-hmm.
And for explosives, you get chunks going, flying. You get big chunks, little chunks, and between size chunks.
Well,
you don't get uniform powder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, goodness. And we're about to hit a break, but you've got to go. If you're sitting at home listening to this, drjudywood.com. And there's two pages. The primary front page is great, and then the WTC Cliff Notes, which is at the far right end of Dr. Wood's banner page. All right, we'll be back after the bottom of the hour break to continue what really happened on 9/11 with Dr. Judy Wood. Snow Patrol there, and a song called Shut Your Eyes and Sink. Yeah, so shut your eyes, and that seems to be what a lot of people have done around the whole 9/11
thing. Shut their minds.
And I don't know, the day it happened, it just didn't feel right to me. It just, nothing felt right about the whole story that day.
Even just watching, if you watched on TV, you couldn't help but notice the way the buildings, quote, came apart.
Well, there's still a whole lot of questions left with this this psyop, this black op.
Right.
Quotes from Cheney and where are the planes and
planes. I mean, that was a whole nother thing. Except for this top secret missions, everybody else was told to
get down,
stand up.
As these buildings fell to the ground, how much mass, Dr. Wood, did you guess was just missing on the ground?
Almost all of it.
Almost all.
Wow.
If you look at some of the pictures that were taken about noon on 9/11, and you know what day it is because in the background you can see Building 7 still standing, and it no longer was standing at about 5:20 that day, but before 5:20, Building 7 was still standing. So there's this picture from West Street looking towards Building 7, and you should have a 110-story building between you and Building 7. But there's nothing down to the ground.
Wow.
And there's an ambulance parked out in front of what was Tower 1. It's still parked there, right, you know, ground level. But there's just no building behind it. Since the tower is over the remains of Tower 1.
Yeah, all there was is a little bit of that steel external structure left behind. So can these weapons, what happens when you demolecularize, you deassociate the materials? What happens to the mass?
I'm not sure exactly what happens to it, but it appeared to have gone up and out and floated around. One of the most interesting pictures I saw was about a block north of the North Tower, and the wind was coming out of the north, blowing south at about 5 miles an hour on that day. And so here you are, a block north, just after the dust settled, about maybe 10 or 15 minutes after Tower 1 went poof. I don't say collapse, it went poof. And you get a clear blue sky in the distance. So that had to be pretty coarse dust to settle out of the air that quickly. And then you start noticing what I call fuzzballs around the feet of the firefighters and the policemen standing there. And it looks like their feet have kicked up this really fine dust, that there's no way that fine a dust could have settled out of the air that quickly. And then pictures a little bit later show that, you know, hazy stuff lifting out off the ground all by itself without even needing to walk on it. So it appears that coarse dust lands on the ground and then continues breaking down until the fineness of it caused it to just start wafting upwards.
So you're saying it's still apart.
Disassociating, yeah.
And I believe it still is to this day.
So basically the fuzz balls were kind of evidence that the dust was continuing to break down and become finer and finer.
Yes, yes.
Would you speculate then that that's one of the reasons why there are such health issues with the 9/11 rescuers?
I can't imagine what breathing that stuff would do to you.
Yeah. Mm. Well, and maybe this is the first large-scale experiment with that.
Well, let's hope not. But
but it's done. But,
yeah,
it's
done. I know.
And then it's that's just creepy. Well,
And I was there a couple of days ago, and noticed that Bankers Trust, maybe in the last year, they've been able to dismantle just one more floor.
Mm-hmm.
That's another puzzle in itself. The Bankers Trust building was directly across Liberty Street from Tower 2. It's the one that had that big gash in the front.
Right, right.
They repaired the gash, and then they decided to take the building apart.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because they've got continuous cleanup, even just till today. They're continuing to haul truckloads of this stuff up. And I had heard that Deutsche Bank, which is the one you're talking about, was being rebuilt, but then suddenly they've torn it down.
Oh, no, they're in the process of tearing it down, and it'll take years and years. I think it was in 2004 they decided to start taking it apart.
But why are they continuing all this cleanup consistently? I mean, it's been going since 2001.
I believe it's because the material is still continuing to break down.
Wow. So once the bonds have been broken, it's going to decay at a quicker rate than it would normally.
Yeah.
When I started listing all of the phenomena, and then, you know, what the day that things really came together for me, I was looking at that picture of the tipping top of Tower 2.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been talking with some folks about steam explosions because this myth that there's molten metal. Well, if there's molten metal and when it rains, you should have had a steam explosion. Or when there's a, you know, fire hose on something. And because when water turns to steam, it expands in volume by 1,600 times.
Right.
And looking at the tipping top of Tower 2, it looked like the building, the solid matter, was doing the same thing. Like it suddenly needed more volume to expand out. Instead of the molecules being attracted to one another, it looks like the sign flipped, and they were now repelling each other suddenly.
Wow.
So I started looking up that phenomenon, and I found the Casimir force, some information on that. It was on John Hutchison's website. And then I started reading more about his stuff and went, oh, my gosh, it was just a one-to-one correlation. And the thing that really got me was the statement that if there was a large amount of mass, that the process might not be self-quenching. In other words, it might continue.
Oh.
Wow.
A large enough mass. So there could be a mass. There were no bigger buildings to point those beams at then.
That something larger than the towers was affected, that would be even worse, I would think.
Well, and I wonder if these beams then directed at the buildings don't continue into the ground, and that's one of the reasons why they haven't built on that site yet, is because it's simply not physically stable yet.
Yeah, there's something that's going on there. When I was there in 2007, I saw some of the grapplers digging around in the ground, suddenly hit something. It looked like they hit a puffball, and up would pop a big poof of white fumes.
Wow.
And then they dump dirt on it and stir it around, scoop the dirt up and haul the dirt out, bring in new dirt and dump it down, stir it around, haul it back out. Kind of interesting, this dirt.
All that dirt. And then the fuming. You keep talking about the fuming. That fuming of the dirt pile, it seemed, did you not mention, it decreased when it's watered. But wouldn't that be contrary to fumes caused by an actual fire or heat?
Yes. Yes, indeed. And something that is really intriguing is West Street had a water main that broke on the afternoon of 9/11. And there's a photo of, I call it the West Lake instead of West Street. The street was just totally flooded out. And in that lake was one of those places where they supposedly had temperature measurements of 1,000 degrees or something like that, or 800 degrees.
Wow.
And you know they can't be because the water wasn't boiling.
The water didn't boil, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, and all the heat was at the top of the buildings. All right, we'll be back with Dr. Judy Wood as we continue to discuss 9/11. We'll open the phones at the top of the hour. Stick with us. America Now. All right, guys. A little Wilco there. Song called White Light. Who knows? That may be the sun on July 7th, Barb. If these crop circle messages keep coming through as deliberate and blatant as they have been, we got something coming on July 7th, and it's a whole lot bigger than the World Trade Center issue. Now, on the phone with us is Dr. Judy Wood, and Barb and I are sitting here looking through your site again, like we did last time when we talked to you. The photographic evidence is stunning. We're on the Cliff Notes page, Dr. Mm-hmm. Wood, and down on figure 33. And it's steel columns disintegrating into steel dust with World Trade Center and a water tower in the foreground. And what it is the result of, there's still superstructure of WTC. I don't know whether it's one or two, but you can see it just turning to dust in midair. It just falls apart. It melts. It's like butter.
Yeah.
Right. Those were core columns from Tower 1, and they stood about 800 feet tall. And some of the pictures you can see there, they stand way above Building 7.
Way above?
Way, yeah.
So
much higher.
Tower 1 peels down like a banana, peeling away from those core columns. And those core columns stay there for a couple of seconds, and then they just kind of poof. And if you mm-hmm. notice the abrupt edge of them suddenly becomes hazy.
Very hazy, cloud.
And then it turns to dust. It's no longer has a distinct boundary. Now, a lot of people argue that things tipped over. Well, if they tipped over and they're 800 feet tall,
then where are they?
They would have taken out a few city blocks of buildings, sliced
at least.
In half.
Well, they didn't tip over in one piece. They tipped over in billions of pieces.
And the fact that they were standing by themselves, unsupported, 800 feet tall steel columns. That's incredible. They were rigid. They were strong. How did they suddenly become unstrong?
Well, and it's not even that they came unstrong. It's just that it's like they were drawn with an Etch-a-Sketch, and somebody vibrated the Etch-a-Sketch, and then they were just gone.
The vibrating. That's the key word right there. Yeah, it's a resonance. And each.
Do you know about the survivors of Stairwell B?
Go ahead and tell us.
We've heard the story, but
there's 14, I believe, the firefighters or mm-hmm. people. In, I think one was a civilian in Stairwell B when the tower came apart, and I believe it was the base of those core columns that we see turning to dust. And for some reason, it missed that spot. And these folks were expecting, you know, the beam of all beams to come clunking down on them at any minute, mm-hmm. and it never happened. And then when the dust cleared out of the air above them, they could look up and see blue sky.
None of it makes.
Well, there were bees in the center of the building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow. One of the funniest things I remember when I was reading through the first responder transcripts is one of the people in Stairwell B were have Maydays going out, you know, calling for help. Where are you? Stairwell B, Tower 1. Somebody on the outside says, where? Tower 1, Stairwell B. Where are you? Stairwell B, Tower 1. Where's Tower 1? Because they couldn't see any building left. They just couldn't believe that anybody was there.
Yeah.
They thought it was, you know, somebody speaking from the beyond.
Well, if it would have been a pancake collapse, and they would have been under hundreds and hundreds of tons of debris, and they probably wouldn't have been able to have gotten to them. But if you're going to dustify the building and the steel columns are going to just simply vanish and blow away, then I suppose you could survive a WTC crash around you.
Yeah, the building did not land on these people, and they were right in the center of the building.
Well, and that kind of goes along with how do you explain how the Ground Zero workers who went down into the sub-basements of, what was it, World Trade Center, probably 2, I think, they found extensive damage, but they didn't find the building debris at the bottom of the hole. How do you explain that as well?
On this Cliff Notes page, you'll find several places I have an audio recording where it says, anybody down there? You hear this big echo.
Really? Oh.
And it sounds like it's an empty parking garage, not even a full parking garage.
Mm.
It just echoes.
Wow.
You'd expect all the tons and tons and tons of debris to be coming down and be somewhere.
Yeah, somewhere. Well, what I'm then wondering about, if the steel simply blew away, you know, those huge girders blew away, then, you know, we know that a lot of the steel was carted off to China and largely
How do we know that?
We don't know that, do we?
We've been told that.
And to explain why there's no steel at Ground Zero, if you look at that picture from before noon on 9/11, because you can see Building 7 off in the distance, fuming away, so you know what day it is. Everything's pretty much one story high.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Where is the steel? There is some. It's not zero amount of steel, but it's not 110 stories worth. It's like one or two stories.
Well, what I was getting to was I was curious about the integrity of the steel that they did haul away. You know, if that has been incorporated into new buildings, and if we still have demolecularization continuing to this day, then that appears to create a safety risk for whatever was built with the resultant steel.
Yeah, I do not know what happened to it and where they took it.
Was there not some of the steel, though, found that it actually turned... Well, it had rapid aging. It had turned almost as though it was iron and was rusting. Did they not find some of that?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that was one of the things that I noticed early on is, you know, buildings are made out of like A36 steel because it has superior structural properties as well as a resistance to environmental degradation. You know, if you build a building out of iron, it's going to rust.
Right.
But steel doesn't rust as much. It has, you know, carbon and some other doodads in there that keep it from rusting.
So
how do you get steel to instantly rust?
Transmutation at the elemental level?
I think we've all been guilty of leaving an iron skillet in the sink for an hour or two. You know, scrub it and then leave it soaking, and it turns bright orange with rust.
Mm-hmm.
We saw the same thing in steel pipes. the only way that happens is if the outer layer of steel actually becomes iron, because it's dissociated. It's separated out from the various constituents, like, you know, the carbon and so forth, is no longer attached.
So let me ask you, Dr. Wood, how could the metal change that way? How can you, what would cause the transmutation?
Well, I look at experimental evidence, and we have a proof of concept of this with John Hutchison's work. He's shown transmutation of materials. He's had stainless steel rust and turn into a few other things to get that. You know how copper gets that bright green creeping crud on it? He's got stainless steel that has patches of that on it.
Wow.
And it also looks kind of shrunken in that place. Another thing I discovered when looking at some of John Hutchison's samples was that a magnet would stick to one part that was affected and not stick to the parts that were not affected.
Interesting.
By this field effect.
Interesting. So that, So what we have is another portfolio of weapons that is largely secret and probably the result of all of that investment in the 70s and 80s in the Star Wars program.
And even before that, Nikola Tesla.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, he's not easy to forget for me.
I want to go to some of the things with Tesla, and especially in some of those pictures where you have the Tesla coil with those little, like, strings coming off of them. Those show up in those pictures of the World Trade Center, those kinds of strings, silly strings, or whatever you were calling.
What I've done is, to keep from biasing my observations, I've used simple terms for things. That, like, if we call this hazy stuff smoke, then we automatically think of fire. So I call it fumes as just a generic term. Mm-hmm. We don't know if it's, you know, chemical vapors or, you know, from fire or what it is. And this other interesting phenomenon I call silly string.
Well,
like silly string.
Let's pick that up after the break, and we'll be back.